a series entitled, Who Do You Say I Am?, which is a question that Jesus asks and a question that we are exploring. Danielle has covered a couple of those subjects, Messiah, Son of David, and today I'm going to cover the next installment, which I'm calling Moses and the Paradox of Piety. Again, the central question that we're asking is, who is Jesus? Who do we say that Jesus is? And by addressing that question and hopefully answering that question or coming to some sort of resolve or some response to that question, we can have a better understanding of who we are, what Christianity is supposed to be all about, and what our behavior is supposed to look like. So that's kind of the general idea. To start with, I'd like to see how astute you are. We're going to do a little bit of a cognitive quiz. Is that okay? A quiz? See how smart you are? Are you ready? Are you prepared? What is this? A what? A dingle hopper? Oh, very nice. I got some Disney references in there. Yes, maybe, I don't know. I'm going to propose, however, that your definition, while maybe semantically accurate, is incredibly insufficient and misses the complete point. I would propose to you that this is an instrument designed by human that epitomizes the convergence of functional design, cultural evolution, demarcating a distinctive boundary between human beings and the animal kingdom by expressing a sophisticated synthesis of utilitarian craftsmanship and symbolic sophistication. Sure. Somebody is humoring me at this particular point, and I appreciate that. Okay, let's continue on. What is this? Red card. It's an official. It's a red card. Now, see, less of you are responding now because I've set you up and I let you down. So I apologize about that. Yeah, okay, so it's a red card. For those of you who follow the sport, know what this is, right? But again, that definition falls flat. It doesn't really exemplify the fullness of it. I'm going to propose to you that this is an authoritative conflict resolution tool that establishes justice and order by penalizing misconduct and ceremonially affirming the ethical standards that underpin appropriate sportsmanship, thus delineating a crucial boundary between permissible behavior and gross transgressions and disregard for the integrity of the game. That's it, right? Okay. Four? Come on. Four and a half. Thank you. Thank you. See what happens when you beg? What is this? Oh, so some of you are still with me. I appreciate that. Okay, it's a passport. Yeah. No, not really. I mean, sure, but does that really communicate what this is? This is really a socio-historical tribal agreement between individuals and states validating the geopolitical and diplomatic agreements that structure international relationships, granting permission for mobility, opportunity, and protections under international law, establishing both individual autonomy and state sovereignty. Yes?
Huzzah.
Huzzah. Okay, are you with me? Do you understand that these things that we've just identified are actually far more intricate and complicated and nuanced and meaningful from a cultural perspective than just merely fork, red card, passport? Some of you are like, where the heck are you going with this? Last one. What is this? For those of you listening to the podcast, it's a sign that says persons having current active diarrhea or who have had active diarrhea within the previous 14 days shall not be allowed to enter the pool water. I cannot tell you how hard I laughed the first time I saw one of these signs. All right, so what is this? This is just common decency. Come on. Come on. That's just common decency. Come on, man. Come on, son. So why the heck do I start with all of this? In this particular series, we have been asking some questions about who Jesus is. Now, there are religious answers to that question. There are spiritual answers to that question. There are maybe theological, all sorts of different ways in which you can answer the question. And I'm just going to answer basically the question right up front. But then I want to get to what are the nuances? What is the meaning of that? And the answer is very, very simply. The gospel writers, when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are very clearly articulating that Jesus is the new Moses. There's the answer. That's all we need to know. Son of David, Messiah. Next week, we're going to talk about Logos, the Word, the Divine, all that kind of stuff. For today, it is very, very clear. So we're just going to stipulate that Moses is the character that's in the mind of the authors of Matthew through John when they write about Jesus. And I'll just give you some very quick glimpses of this. There's many more of these, obviously. So we'll just go over a few of them to kind of paint the picture for you. First, do you remember the story of Moses when there was a decree by Pharaoh to slaughter the babies? Do you remember that Moses, therefore, was also birthed in hiding as a result of that decree? He murders an Egyptian, and then as a result of finding out, he flees from Egypt. He finds safety among non-Israelites. Moses himself being an Israelite, that's, of course, the Midianites and his father-in-law Jethro, all that story. And again, if you're not familiar with this story, don't worry. This will make sense eventually. He spends 40 years in the wilderness, and Moses' life is actually broken up into segments of 40. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in exile after he leaves, and then 40 years in wandering as he leads out. So the 40 becomes this very symbolic number in Moses' life. He liberates the people. I left a question mark there intentionally because we're going to talk about what kind of liberation are we talking about here. And then, of course, after he leads the people out of Egypt, the big story that many of us know, of course, spreading the waters, parting the waters with the whole thing with the cane and all that kind of stuff, he goes up to the mountain and receives the law, the Torah, the teachings, the Ten Commandments. Now, if you take a quick look at the way the gospel writers are positing the story of Jesus, you will find almost identical parallels. Pharaoh decreed the slaughter of the babies. Herod also decreed a slaughter of the babies. As a result of that slaughter, there is a birth or a hiding in shame, although the birth for Jesus is also a escape from that command by Herod, but also concern about the propriety of the relationship between Joseph and Mary. So there's all sorts of other nuances there. They fled to Egypt rather than from Egypt, but either way, both of them are coming out of Egypt. Jesus is visited by non-Jews, magi, Babylonian astrologers, so some connection there with non-Israelites. Of course, as 40 years in the wilderness, Jesus is tempted 40 days in the wilderness. Again, the 40 is very significant for that symbolic connection. And many people, and when I look this up, people would say frequently that if Moses liberated people out of Egypt, Jesus is liberating people out of sin. Now, I left that blank there because I want us to wrestle with that question. And then, of course, Moses goes up on the mountain for the law. Jesus goes up on the mountain and delivers the law, what we call the Sermon on the Mount. Now, I went over this very quickly. If you are interested in studying this more in depth, there are multiple nuances and connections and stories and even linguistic connections between the story in Exodus and the story in Matthew, etc. It's very, very fascinating. And the gospel writers are actually brilliant at painting this picture. For now, at least at this particular stage, all I simply want to impress upon us is that the gospel writers are suggesting, who do you say Jesus is? We say he's the new Moses. Got it? The new Moses. But this poses a question, of course. If Jesus is the new Moses, then who was Moses? Who was he? What did he do? What did he accomplish? And what kind of reputation does that man have in our cultural sensibilities for which we are projecting onto Jesus? Oh, Jesus is now doing the same thing that Moses did. So let me ask you this question. What do you think of when you think of Moses? What comes to mind? What are the images, the ideas, the story pieces? Charlton Heston.
Silver hair.
Silver hair. Okay. What else comes to mind when you think of Moses?
Ten Commandments.
Parting the Red Sea. Did I say that right?
King of Egypt.
Plagues.
Burning bush.
All sorts of wonderful
whiny
things.
People.
I'm sorry?
Whiny people.
Never mind. I was gonna say something snarky about church. What was that, Ivan?
He started life at 81.
Yeah. Okay. His third act, right? He shows up back to Egypt. He's 81, third act, I'm going to liberate an entire nation. That's not a bad calling at the age of 81. Very nice. So most of you are already mentioning all of these particular pieces. When I searched a general idea, like what is the main thrust of the Moses story that has captivated our cultural consciousness? You guys have already mentioned it. It looks something like
this. Let my people go.
Charlton Heston. Let my people go. The image in the picture of Moses that ultimately comes to mind is that there is oppression, slavery, a group of people that is hoarding over another group of people and making their lives miserable. And this is an injustice. And the fundamental theme from the Moses story that most people get from all of that, the burning bush, Charlton Heston, parting of the Red Seas, all of that is fundamentally about this. It is a liberation from tyranny, from oppression, from empire, and from injustice. Is that the Moses story? I already gave it away. Yes, it is the Moses story. Liberation is, there's a reason why Moses plays a huge part in many of the liberation and civil rights movements throughout our history. It's because Moses is that figure that captivates that grand idea, the story that honestly never grows old. Apparently, Netflix is coming out with a whole new series on the biography of Moses, which I'll be interested to see how they depict that. But again, when I saw the trailer, much of it was about this, a humble human being who had very humble beginnings and didn't articulate well, couldn't speak, had all these faults and failures, leading a group of people out from tyranny, oppression, empire, and injustice. And that, my friends, is absolutely part of the Moses story. And we need to captivate that idea when we think about Jesus being the new Moses by painting those parallels together. When Jesus comes along, there is a liberation out of these things. And rather than Egypt and Pharaoh being the oppressor, in Jesus' time, it is Rome and the emperor, right? And the religious people who are hoarding over religious ideas at the oppression of the people, right? So that's part of it. Very rarely do I hear the second part of the Moses story, which is actually far more prominent in the Moses story. The Exodus story that we just talked about, if you just do the real estate, the number of passages that mention the liberation out of Egypt, 12, 14, maybe 23 passages, 23 chapters, depending upon how you want to count it. Out of the entirety of what is attributed to Moses, which includes Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, very rarely do we think about these other elements of Moses. We think about this, because this is what makes great theater. This is what demands Charlton Heston come to the big screen, right? This is what makes it happen. But there's another part of the Moses story that we don't think about that is actually intricately tied to this idea. And to get at that idea, part of what we do here at Spark is try to recontextualize, which means ask first the question, what did this story mean to them, before we ask the question, what does it mean to us? To get at that, we have to go to some ancient literature. I would like to introduce you to a gentleman, a philosopher, a Jewish philosopher by the name of Philo of Alexandria. As Junior was reminding me, it's actually pronounced Philo in the Greek, but nonetheless, everybody says Philo because we are anglicized and domineering colonizers, apparently. So not. Philo, sorry, I'll scratch that. Sorry, that was not in the script. Philo of Alexandria. He was born somewhere between 15 and 10 BC, as you can see, approximately a decade before Jesus. And Philo had no life because he wrote so much material, it's ridiculous. These books are huge. And he wrote extensively about the Jewish people, about philosophy, the interplay between Greek philosophy like Plato and Aristotle, but also in connection with the Hebrew scriptures and people like, guess who? Moses. So what I'd like to do, and some of these passages are long, but just hang with me here, because Philo is going to paint a picture of Moses in a very different light than the standard cultural picture of Moses that we have grown accustomed to seeing. The very first thing that Philo does is, if you notice the subtitle there, On Humanity, is make a connection to not only Moses' leadership out of oppression, but Moses' moral and ethical teachings as being a way of creating a whole new view of what it means to be human. This wasn't just a religious idea. This wasn't just a spiritual idea. This wasn't just an idea that stuck with people who happen to believe in God. No, the vision that Philo is going to paint of Moses is that he uttered forth teachings, morals, ethics, ideas, innovations in human behavior that created a far better kind of human than had previously done. Let's share some of these examples. We must now proceed in due order to consider that virtue, which is more nearly related to piety, being as it were a sister, a twin sister, namely humanity, which the Father of our laws loved so much that I know not if any human being was more attached to it. He's talking about Moses, the kind of character and person he was, loved humanity so much that he dedicated himself to the virtue of piety. And this is going to become a theme in the next several pages of what Philo writes. Here are some excerpts to kind of illustrate that the piety that we hold is part of how you become human. For he knew that this was, as it were, a plain and level road conducting to holiness. I know the language is very difficult. Some of that is the ancient Greek, and some of that is the license of the interpreters. Therefore, he trained and instructed all the people who were in subjection to himself in precepts of fellowship, the most excellent of all lessons, exhibiting to them his own life as an archetypal model for them to copy. Do you hear what he's saying? He's saying, I'm going to show you what it's like to be human, how to be holy, and I'm going to show you not in just what I write, but in how I act and how I behave. My life is going to be a model for this new humanity. And then we get some clues into what kind of view and perspective Philo thought Moses had. Moses would reply in one particular passage, "It is proper to make God the judge in everything, and most especially in those things in which the acting well or ill brings innumerable multitudes of happiness or on the contrary to misery." We have a choice. We get to bring happiness or we get to bring misery. And there is nothing of greater importance than sovereign authority to which all the affairs of cities in war or peace are committed. I wish we could park here for a long time, because what he's suggesting here is that there are people that exist in the world and they have decided that they are the authority for what is good and what is bad, for what is happiness and what is misery. And those people happen to sit on thrones. Those people happen to have stories that suggest that they are divinely given the right by the gods. Those people are mere humans created in the image and likeness of God, but they are humans nonetheless. And for some reason, for some hubris, they have decided that they're in charge. They get to make the rules. And what Philo is saying, Moses is the guy who did the exact opposite. Rather than appealing to his own personhood, he appealed to God. Because I can see what kind of world gets created when humans own that authority. And this is going to be a really important theme that really requires some teasing out, but just get the impression right now. People are making the rules. People are in charge. Humanity is running the show. And what Moses comes along and says, that's what got us into slavery in Egypt. That's what gets the Babylonians to slaughter everybody who they don't like. That's what gets the Romans to crucify everybody that comes up against that. It's when people are in charge. So you know what the solution to that is? We need a higher authority, one that goes above the humans. For as in order to make successful voyage, one has need of a pilot that is both virtuous and skillful, in the same manner there is need of a very wise governor in order to secure the good government of the subjects in every quarter. Now here's where he's starting to get to the gist of it. Part of the problem of these people is that they have no sense of virtue. They have no reverence of the divine. They have no humility and appeal to a higher authority. These are people who are skillful, but they don't have the virtue. They don't have the moral core to drive forward their principles and to create a good humanity. And I love this. Just in the same way, if you need to take a voyage, you want somebody who knows how to drive the boat, but who knows how to care for the people on the boat. Very much like we need governors who are going to do the same thing. Moreover, wisdom is a thing not only more ancient than my own birth, but even than the creation of the universal world. Nor is it lawful nor possible for anyone to decide in such a matter, but God alone. And those who love wisdom with guilelessness, innocence, sincerity, truth. I have learned by myself not to approve of as fit for dominion any of those men who appear to be suitable. Listen, wisdom goes far beyond me, Moses says. Philo says that Moses says. Wisdom is far above me. Who am I to suggest, therefore, I now need to take charge that I know I must appeal to something greater? By the way, a very quick note on humility. Many of you have heard the story of Moses, that like in the writings of Moses, there's this passage that says Moses was the most humble man in the entire world, right? There's that passage in Numbers and stuff, and people go, why would a humble man write that, right, in the writings? I would like to propose that, just a little note on the side, part of the reason why all of that is written, part of the reason why the story of the Exodus is written, where Moses can't speak, he hides from a snake, he doesn't want to go, he finally sends, is because the author is setting up this kind of humility. Somebody who wants the job of power probably isn't the right person for the job of power. And what the Exodus writers are doing, what Philo is catching up on, picking up on here, is that's what Moses is. He's an image and a picture of somebody who achieves this level of authority but does not want it. We have now then spoken of the proofs of the humanity of the lawgiver, which he displayed by the admirable disposition of his own excellent nature, and also partly by the expositions which he has given in the sacred volumes. So Moses models it, and then he teaches it. He writes it down, and he gives it to the people to say, this is how you must live. There is virtue and piety to be had. You got freed from Egypt. Now you need an additional freedom. And what he writes is just insane. It's really kind of wonderful to see. Therefore, we must look upon and denominate the opulence of money changers and usurers as poverty, though they appear to themselves to be mighty kings, while they never beheld that wealth, which is really endowed with sight. No, not even in their dreams. I love that line. They can't even dream of the wealth that they have. They make usurious advances, even of food. And I love this. Lending it on condition of receiving back again more than they lent, and making a revenue of the hunger and the bellies of miserable men. There are people taking advantage of poor people and making them suffer even more. And this, Moses says, shall not be. And he says that when we violate this, a thoroughly slavish and illiberal mind, which must be changed into savageness and into the resemblances of brute beasts before it could adopt them. The reason why these people do this is because they have dehumanized themselves. The way that you oppress other people is to dehumanize them, but it's also to dehumanize yourself. And he even gets very specific. Every employer is to pay the wages of the poor man the same day that they are earned. I can't believe you have to write that down. The California Labor Code says that. I'm like, where did they get? Well, apparently, 2,000 years ago, this was something that needed to be said. Why? Because people in power don't do this. We don't have time to go through pages and pages and pages of what Philo articulates, what Moses said, which is what is appropriate and good. Lending, tending to the fields, wealth extraction, sanctuary care, grant. Like, there's even rules for how you are to welcome people in hospitality. There's rules for how you create your clothes. By the way, do we have problems with how our clothes are created today at the oppression of other people, right? I mean, does this sound familiar? Nothing ultimately has changed. Animal husbandry, how you treat your birth mother rights. Don't kill your own children, which I love that had to be in there, because apparently that's a problem every now and then. Don't muzzle, like, it just goes on and on and on.
Hear me. Oh, hear me. All pay heed. The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15. Ten commandments for all to obey.
What we have forgotten and neglected in our cultural consciousness is that Moses is not just the liberator, he is also the law giver. And what's really fascinating is when you read the story carefully, liberation and law are actually the same thing. And while it's really important for us to recognize that tyranny and oppression and empire should be elements of our human experience that should just disappear, there's a paradox here. That true liberation actually comes when you remember the second half of Moses' life and story, which is the establishment of piety and laws and submission to those laws and rules. Because as Philo writes about, Moses knew exactly what happened when people don't do that. I don't like these pictures sometimes when you look them up because there's this harshness to the law, but there are some images and senses that what Moses is doing with the tablets is very much like Hammurabi, which is an ancient Babylonian king, receiving the commandments from Shamash, the god. The idea there, again, is this humility piece. It's not something that I came up with. It comes from above. It's a wisdom beyond me. And it's a wisdom to which I submit. And this is what I propose to you, my friends, when the gospel writers suggest that Jesus is the new Moses, when Jesus goes up on the mountain to then give the commands, the new laws, the new teachings. He's doing so in the tradition of Moses because the teachings, the laws, the commands, the principles, the morals, the ethics are what liberate you. Those are the elements that come as the other part of liberation. Another side note, Danielle talked about the eyewitnesses. This picture that I found, I don't know which, somebody will have to tell me where this comes from, but has a guy in the back with notes, taking notes, which I thought was really amazing because we had talked about how, you know, did we really write down the original words of Jesus? There are some who suggest maybe we actually did, and there the guy is. So my friends, my suggestion to you is that Moses and Jesus are definitely linked and connected in the gospel stories. We understand Moses to be the great liberator, but the vast majority of Moses' writings or what is attributed to Moses is law, codes, ethics, morals, rules, commands. And if you want to be liberated and free, you accept both. Liberation of the people from tyranny, oppression, empire, injustice. But it is also liberation of people by the establishment of law, morals, rules, and personal devotion to those principles. This is the great paradox of piety. And according to Philo, what ultimately makes us human? The fork, the passport, the red card, these are what make us human. This is what makes life thrive, to create those boundaries of play, to create those rules that should never be transgressed, to ensure also that we adhere to them, that we care deeply about them, that we have personal devotion to them. Piety is what makes us human. And every now and then, the movies get it right. Although it's very, very quick in the script, notice what Moses says here. Charlton, whoever you want to say. Notice what he says.
Let my people go.
The slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they own is mine. I do not know your God, nor will I let Israel go.
Who are you to make their lives bitter in hard bondage? Man shall be ruled by law, not by the will of other men.
I love that little scuttlebutt at the very end. Oh, did he just say that? No, Pharaoh is the law. And that is exactly correct. The story that Philo is painting of Moses is not one of just get me out of oppression. But I don't want to be ruled by a tyrant. I want to be ruled by a God who knows what the rules are supposed to be. We should be ruled by laws. Laws, rules, regulations, these are what make us human. There are consequences to when we break those rules. There are consequences to life when we, nobody? No, no? It took a little while. It's like, there are consequences to when we break laws. And the idea is like the breaking of those commands, the breaking of those virtues actually leads to bad things. And that's why we have them. We have them to protect ourselves. We have them to ensure proper social order. We have them to ensure that life can actually thrive. That, my friends, is a tradition from Moses. And we do so because we are not animals. Animals do not care about those laws or those rules. But we are human, and we do or we should. And part of the reason why I'm spending time on this today is because I'm going to guess that many of us are familiar with a very radical and frustrating cultural disruption that is happening in our current context, where an idea has been captivated and it has been used in the sense of the former part of the Moses story. I'm liberated. I'm free. What are you talking about? Don't put anything on me. Don't put any rules or restrictions or guidelines around me. I can say whatever I damn well please because I have this liberation idea in front of me. But as you know, that's not true liberation. That kind of usage of that freedom is another kind of tyranny. And this can go to virtually every single rule or command that we have. The idea that I can do whatever I damn well please because I'm free and Christ has let me free. We don't need the law anymore. That's part of what comes in theological circles. We don't need that anymore. We don't need this anymore because I can do whatever I want. And we can extrapolate passages that show us that freedom. But inside the entirety of the text is the idea that freedom definitely comes from liberation from tyranny and oppression, but liberation also comes by adherence to the rules and the commands and the decrees. And that, my friends, is the full-fledged nature of liberation. In the House of Congress, in our own United States government, there are, I don't know if you've ever noticed this before, I'm sure many of you who have ever taken tours to the Capitol, you've noticed that there are people that stand or are portrayed at the very top of the rim of the House of Representatives. Every single one of them are people that are representatives of wisdom or ideas that have been passed down. Edward I, Hammurabi is listed up there, Jefferson, Napoleon, people throughout our history that have given us this kind of wisdom. And the idea is we are elevating ourselves, or we should elevate ourselves to this wisdom that Philo talks about that is beyond me, above me, before me. And I submit myself to that wisdom. That's the idea behind here. Now notice, every single one of those facades are faced in a direction because they are pointing to one face that is directly above on the opposite wall of the dais. Does anybody want to guess what face that is? The only face that is facing direct is facing down. And the reason for that is because Moses, depending upon which historian you read, let me clarify that, depending upon which historian you read, Moses is that representative in our story that we have brought into our American story of the conflation, the joining together, the marriage of true liberation coming because of good laws and adherence to those laws and adherence to that piety. And this is instantiated in our history, Benjamin Franklin. Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom and no such thing as public liberty. Without freedom of speech. Yes, we need that liberty. We need to be able to say what we need to be able to say without fear or favor. But then also, Thomas Jefferson, no government ought to be without censors. And where the press is free, no one ever will. That is the point, is that you can't just say whatever you want to say because that is a different kind of tyranny. Adherence to the laws. And by the way, I'm kind of missing it. It's not just adherence to the laws. It is a deep, personal, pietous conviction that those laws matter and that my life should be subjected to them because that is how humanity comes forth. In the words of Pope John Paul II, freedom consists not in doing what we like, but in having the right to do what we ought. Put it this way, I've been saying it already, liberation without piety is another form of anarchy, another version of disorder, just a different kind of tyranny. So my friends, I'm proposing to you that Jesus is the new Moses. The gospel writers are clearly articulating that Moses is that archetype of which Jesus is now fulfilling. Just like Moses lived his life and what he did for our people, Jesus is now doing the same thing. But what Moses did is liberate and give us laws and called us to piety. What Jesus is doing is also liberating us, freeing us, casting off the burden from oppression and empire and tyranny, but also goes up on the mountain and says, don't do this. Don't commit adultery. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't dishonor your fellow human beings. Don't usurp their kindness. Have compassion, justice, and mercy. Don't be a hypocrite. If you read Jesus carefully, he sounds a lot like Moses, who wrote a whole lot of those laws. And Jesus is doing the same thing. Yes, be freed from the tyranny of empire, oppression, and injustice. Yes. But also submit yourself to the teachings, the laws, the boundaries, the parameters, the rules, the regulations, the morals, the ethics that support a flourishing humanity. Because the Torah, the teachings, is just as much a part of the liberation story as is the Exodus. Moses said so, Philo says so of Moses, Jesus reiterates, Pope John Paul is just following in the same tradition. So, my friends, what are these now? What are they? Fork, red card, passport, common decency. And I threw in some other things, regulations, rules, compliance, policy, standards. I will tell you, I can't stand some of these laws. They are a burden. I get it. And sometimes we don't like them. Sometimes we want to break them. Sometimes we think that, you know, life is found in breaking the rules. But the reason why these exist, and the reasons why laws and regulations and rules and standards and policies exist in our faith, is because these are expressions of piety and they are the symbols of human liberation. The reason why we have gained so much in our text of what to do and what not to do, what's right and what is wrong, what is proper and what is improper, is because we know, Moses knew, humanity has taught us throughout these ages that adherence to those laws are what create a good human experience. And this is just the jumping off point, because this goes, by the way, to the rest of what we do. Why do we keep reading this ancient text? What? You still read the Bible? Well, some of us still do. Maybe, I don't know. Why do you do this thing called worship? Why do you disciple? Do we really need the covenant thing anymore? I mean, those are just rules and regulations. Isn't Jesus about freedom and liberation and being nice to one another? I mean, are you going to put some restrictions around my behavior? Are you going to do that? Like, what do we need all that for? Why? Because 2,000 years ago, or even more than that, ancient philosophers said, you know what? You know what Moses did really good? You know what he did really well? He knew how to liberate people, bring freedom, and a whole new sense of humanity. And he did so by casting off the yoke of the Egyptians and providing for the Israelites a code by which they should live. And if they did that, then they'll never end up back in Egypt again. And of course, the problem is that the cycle continued and people actually did end up back in Egypt. And so Jesus comes along to kind of reboot the agenda, cast off the yoke of the Romans and the empire, but submit yourself to the teachings, to wisdom, to fidelity, to covenant, to law. Who do you say that I am? I say you're the new Moses. Who is Moses? The great liberator. The one who brought us freedom by bringing us the teachings. We're going to move into a time of communion, which again is a symbol of who Jesus is and how Jesus lived. Just as Philo talked about Moses' life being an example, these symbols represent the example that Jesus set for us. After we take communion, we're going to sing a song, one of my favorites. Lord, I'm amazed by you, how you love me. Now, in traditional interpretation of that song, it is how amazing it is that you love me and how great that you love me. What I'd like for you to think about if you feel so led, how you love me, that phrase, I'm amazed at how you love me. Oh God, you love me, how? By freeing me, but you also love me by telling me not to run into a crowded street. You love me by telling me not to lie. You also love me by telling me not to steal. You also love me by telling me not to be a hypocrite. I'm amazed at how you love me. And that's the harder side of the equation. But it is also how Jesus loves us. So as we take communion and sing that song, I hope that maybe the Spirit of God might lead you, move you in that sentiment. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." My friends, no matter who you are, no matter what rules or laws you have broken or kept, you are welcome at this table. Please come as we sing.